Good day. Today is Tuesday, 12th August 2025, and I'm going to begin today's programme with a discussion of the very dramatic news from the Ukrainian battlefields in the area of Pokrovsk specifically, where, if the reports are true and the reports are flooding in from both Ukrainian and Russian channels, the Russian military has made what is increasingly looking like a major and perhaps decisive breakthrough. Now, I say all of this, there's still a dearth of information, actual concrete information coming from the battlefronts themselves. There's very little in the way of video footage, for example. There are many reports about movements of Russian troops. Some of them seem to be so far ahead of positions where we might expect the Russians to be that they almost strain credulity. But having said that, they tend to come from very reliable sources on the Russian side, and in many cases they are confirmed by the Ukrainians themselves. Now, saying all of this, it's perhaps also important to say that just 2 or 3 weeks ago, when the first reports began to circulate that the Russians had broken deep into Pokrovsk itself, that they'd reached the centre of the town, again, I was uncertain whether this was really the case. There were lots of claims that these were so-called sabotage and reconnaissance groups, special forces groups, in other words, moving around Pokrovsk, destabilising and confusing the Ukrainian defenders. It became only very gradually clear and fully accepted that, in fact, the Russian army had indeed broken into Pokrovsk and fighting is indeed going on inside the city itself, and that the Russians have indeed reached the centre of the city. So those dramatic reports about Pokrovsk turned out to be true, and I suspect that we're going to find that at least some, and perhaps most, and even all of the dramatic reports coming about the situation north of Pokrovsk are true also. So what do these reports tell us? The first is, yesterday I spoke about how the Russians had supposedly, or had reportedly, reached the village of Zoloty Kolodias. And, well, we've now heard further reports. The Ukrainians themselves have indeed confirmed that the Russians are indeed outside that village. There is a village to the south of Zoloty Kolodias called Kucheriv Yar, which apparently the Russians have encircled. There is another village to the southwest of Zoloty Kolodias, Rubizhne, which the Russians are said to have captured. It's also claimed that the Russians have advanced north of Zoloty Kolodias, where fighting continues to take place, that there is fighting for another village to the northeast of Zoloty Kolodias, which is called Vesyolye, and that the Russians have also advanced and have actually now cut the road from Dobropilia to Kramatorsk. Now, all of this is dramatic news. These places that I've just listed are located well to the northeast of Pokrovsk. They are located to the north of Dobropilia also. Dobropilia is that village to the northwest of Pokrovsk, which has been seen by some as a kind of major rearguard position that the Ukrainian army has established to the rear of Pokrovsk, and which it uses supposedly as a logistical base for the defenders, the Ukrainian defenders in Pokrovsk. So all of this is very dramatic news. It would mean that the Russians have cut another key supply road, supplying and supporting the Ukrainian forces in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And, of course, if they're able to consolidate all of these positions, Then they will have achieved a major breakthrough, and they will have already begun an advance to cut off the remaining towns of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka conurbation from the west. They will be, in other words, working towards an effective encirclement of that group of towns. Now, saying all of this, it's important to stress that as of this time, it's not clear who exactly amongst the Russians is located in all of these places. The Ukrainian military is saying that these are all sabotage and reconnaissance groups, special forces groups, in other words, that these are raids by the Russian military, that the Russian main army is not there yet, and that the fighting that is taking place in all of these villages is by small groups of Russian soldiers fighting small groups of Ukrainian soldiers. And there are reports in Ukraine that the 3rd Azov Brigade, one of the elite brigades of the Ukrainian military, is being rapidly transferred from other parts of the front line to this area to stabilize the situation and to push the Russians back. Now, this may be true. It may be the correct account of what is indeed happening. But of course, there is also a possibility that the Russians are taking advantage of Ukraine's lack of infantry, that they are indeed advancing in force in this area, that they're indeed capturing quickly all of these various villages, as I said, well to the northeast of Pokrovsk, to the northeast of Dobropilia as well, that this is part of an overall Russian strategy. And as I've said already, if the Russians are able to consolidate their control of this territory, then, to say it simply, this is a dagger in the heart of Ukraine. Now, that's one area where we're looking at a major crisis for the Ukrainians in the Pokrovsk area. It gets worse for the Ukrainians in other respects also, because we now have further confirmation that those reports of a couple of days ago from Redovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, about the Russians having crossed the main supply road leading into Pokrovsk from the north between the villages of Rodinskaya and Belitskaya, and having advanced west beyond that road and having reached the village of Shevchenko to the southwest, to the southeast of Dobropilia. It now looks as if those reports were indeed true, and apparently they're being confirmed by Ukrainian sources. And it also seems to be the case that other reports that the that Redovka made, that the Russian forces that have reached Shevchenko are also sending columns southwards, may be true also. And there are reports circulating that the Russians are in the process of attacking a village called Novoalexandrivka, which is located to the southwest of Dobropilia and to the northeast of the key village of Grishinye, which is itself located to the north, sorry, to the northwest of Grishinye, which is itself located to the northwest of Pokrovsk. Now, if all of this is true, and if the Russians again are able to consolidate here and are able to capture Novoalexandrivka and eventually Grishinye itself, then the Russians will have taken Pokrovsk itself in a cauldron. We will no longer be in a situation where we can speak of an escape route for the Ukrainian troops still in Pokrovsk. The escape route will have closed. And that is an interesting development in itself. In many cases, up to now, over the course of this war, when the Russians have encircled a town, They have left an escape route for the Ukrainian defenders to retreat through, because the capture of the town would come at too high a price if the Ukrainian defenders were allowed, were obliged to stay and to defend themselves there. The only occasion I can think of when the Russians have indeed sought to completely close all escape routes was during the siege of Mariupol, when they did in fact succeed in closing all the escape routes. And the result was that the Ukrainian troops, the Azov Brigade and another Marine Brigade that was defending Mariupol, had to retreat into the basement buildings, the underground buildings of the Azovstal factory, where, of course, they were eventually forced to surrender. Now, as I said, I'm not saying that this is exactly the situation, because the reports are scattered and they are all over the place. And it may be, as I said, that some of these Russian advances that I'm talking about are not real, that people are imagining them. That has happened many times in this war. Or that we are indeed talking only about light reconnaissance units rather than the Russian main army seizing control of these positions. So it's possible. But we have to face also the possibility that these reports are indeed real and that it is indeed the Russian army that is, as I said, taking control of all of these positions. Some of them have been confirmed, as I said, by Ukrainian sources, by Deep State, which is, of course, connected to the Ukrainian General Staff, and also by various Ukrainian commentators. There is just too much chatter and reporting about a massive crisis playing out for the Ukrainian military north of Pokrovsk to make it impossible that grave and disastrous things from a Ukrainian point of view are taking place there. So, for example, we have this comment from Bogdan Krotevich, who was a former senior officer of the Azov Brigade, and he has addressed this comment to Zelensky himself. "Mr. President, I honestly don't know what exactly you've been told, but I am telling you, the Pokrovsk-Konstantinovka line is without exaggeration a complete mess. And this mess has been growing for a long time, getting worse every day. Those commands that are currently being appointed or have already been appointed to fix the irreparable will most likely be blamed for the mess that is already happening. The line of combat contact as a permanent line does not actually exist. Pokrovsk and Mirnograd are almost surrounded. Konstantinovka is semi-encircled. The enemy is advancing towards Kramatorsk and Druzhivka. Druzhivka is a small town which is located close to the Slavyansk, well, it's basically part of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. It's located on the western side of this common conurbation. If it is indeed the case that the Russians are indeed in control of all of these positions or have advanced to all of these positions, then I'm talking about, then one can see why Krotevich believes that this place, Druzhivka, is indeed threatened in the way that he says. Another person who is now ringing the alarm bells is not Ukrainian, but German. He is Julian Röpke, the reporter from Bild Zeitung, a major commentator on Ukraine, somebody who's very, very well informed about the military situation in Ukraine. As I've said on many occasions, his perspectives on the war are completely at odds with my own. We don't agree about the war's origins, about how the war is being conducted, about many, many things. But I've always acknowledged that he is an objective reporter to a great extent of the military situation on the battle lines in Ukraine. And he says this, if the Ukrainian army, this is, he says this in a message on Twitter X, if the Ukrainian army does not finally and immediately send a real battalion, not a platoon-sized brigade, to cut off and neutralize every Russian north of Nikanorivka. This is a village northeast of Pokrovsk, which the Russians captured some time ago, a couple of days ago. It can also give Putin Donetsk Oblast for free. Seriously, how long can you close your eyes to not see this? So that's Yulian Repka. He's saying that the situation is so bad that if the Ukrainians aren't able to bring it under control and to bring it all under control very soon, then they might as well kiss goodbye to Donetsk region. The Russians allegedly, reputedly, Putin allegedly, reputedly told Witkoff that he would agree to a ceasefire if the Ukrainians pulled out of Donetsk region. Here we see Yulian Repka saying that the Ukrainians might as well do that because unless they're able to stabilize the situation north of Pokrovsk, they might as well forget about Donetsk region in its entirety because they are on the verge of losing it. Now, those are just two reporters, Krotovich and Repka, one Ukrainian, one German. If you spend your time going through all of the various Telegram channels, the blog pieces, if you follow up the various mapping projects, including the Ukrainian ones, Deep State and all of the others, if you spend your time plowing through the internet, you will find many, many others. There is now unequivocally a massive crisis for the Ukrainians north of Pokrovsk and, by the way, in Pokrovsk itself. I am not there. I am not able to speak to the military people on the ground, on either army. The general staffs of Ukraine and Russia do not share the information they have with me. I'm starting to wonder, by the way, how well-informed the military and political leadership in Kiev actually is about the situation that is developing in Pokrovsk. We'll come to all of that shortly. But the cumulative information that's coming from too many sources on both sides is now too strong to deny that there is a major operational crisis for the Ukrainians north of Pokrovsk. In fact, it's starting to look, and I want to say starting to look, as if we're looking at some kind of major collapse. A major collapse in what is the most important part of the battlefront. Now, all of this is bad. There's lots of bad news, further bad news for the Ukrainians in other places as well. So, over the last 24 hours, there have been further reports that the Russian army has made further advances in the Liman area, for example, that the village of Kolodizy, northeast of Liman, and very close to Liman indeed, has now fallen fully under Russian control, that the Russians are continuing to advance steadily towards Liman, and there doesn't seem to be any ability by the Ukrainians to resist them. There's also reports that the Russians have pushed the Ukrainians south of various villages along the Dnieper River, north of Liman, that the Ukrainians are falling back to two villages of Novozelivka and Drobysheva. If this is true, then the Russians are going to be literally outside Liman in a few days. I mean, it's the situation there is looking as bad as that. And that doesn't even begin with a discussion of what's happening in Zarechny, a village immediately to the west, to the east of Liman. It could be that the crisis is even worse than we know. There's also further news about large numbers of Ukrainian troops trapped inside the Serebyanka forest, cut off from escape routes, surrounded by the Russians, being hunted down by the Russians in the Serebyanka forest. This is located north of Siversk, and of a general collapse of Ukrainian defences in the Siversk area. And there's also been more reports from Kupiansk itself of the Russians now moving again to close the escape routes of the Ukrainian troops in Kupiansk itself. To repeat once more, I'm not physically present in any one of these places. I don't know what is actually going on personally, from personal observation in these places. I have to base my assessments on reports that others provide and on the occasional footage provided by drones, of which, by the way, there's not been very much recently, pointing incidentally to a tight clampdown of information by the two general staffs, which is also perhaps a sign that the situation for the Ukrainians is deteriorating fast. Anyway, I am not there. But to repeat again, I cannot ignore the enormous body of speculation, of commentary, of reports and rumours, many of them provided by people like Röpke and Krotovich, who I suspect are extremely well informed. And just to remind, the information that was provided by Redovka about a Russian advance west of Rodinske towards Shevchenko, it now appears that that report, that earlier report, which seemed very dramatic, it's turning out that it is true. I forgot to mention, incidentally, that there are also reports that the Russians are indeed present on the territory of Rodinske itself, that there is actually fighting going on, that they've captured the small village of Krasny Liman to the southwest of Rodinske, which is basically an outlying suburb of the bigger village of Rodinske itself, that there is fighting going on inside Rodinske. And of course, if there's been a Russian breakthrough to Shevchenko, then Rodinske is itself surrounded, and the Ukrainian troops there are not going to be able to get resupplied. So, a catastrophic situation, one in which one can see what the shortage of infantry, the critical shortage of infantry that the Ukrainian army is experiencing, what that is doing. 3.5 years of attrition have reduced the Ukrainian army to a shadow of its former self. Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, as I discussed in my program yesterday, are saying that the Ukrainian army on the front lines is down to 300,000 men, as against 650,000 Russian troops. I don't know how many Ukrainian troops there are in the Pokrovsk area, but there's said to be 110,000 Russian troops in that area. It looks as if the Ukrainians have no infantry to resist the Russians there, and that the Russians are able to manoeuvre at will across the open steppe, surrounding and capturing villages north of Pokrovsk and cutting all of the main supply roads. And another important fact, which is that even as the Russians advance in all of these places. It has been suggested, it's been reported, including by Ukrainian channels, that some of these places which the Russians have captured or are in the process of capturing or have moved beyond, like Zoloti Kolodyaz, which is located to the northeast of Pokrovsk, well, to the northeast of Pokrovsk, that some of these places were places that were supposed to be part of the big new defense line that the Ukrainians supposedly are feverishly trying to create west of the cities of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka and Pokrovsk, the Ukrainian equivalent of the Surovikin line, the one that the Russians built in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, and which defeated Ukraine's offensive, summer offensive of 2023. This new defense line that the Ukrainians were supposed to be building was supposed to be its equivalent. And if these reports are true, the Russians have already pierced it and have advanced beyond it against minimal resistance. Now, where does all this leave us? Well, Yulia Repka said that if the Russians are able to consolidate control of all of these places, then Donetsk and indeed Donbass are lost. I have to say that it's been obvious to me for several weeks now, about 2 weeks now, that Pokrovsk is also lost. It looks as if the Ukrainians have missed their chance, as is so often the case, to withdraw their troops from Pokrovsk. Maybe the 3rd Azov Brigade will be able to work some miracle to stabilize the situation north of Pokrovsk. But I think it is most unlikely that they will be able to break through into Pokrovsk itself and save the Ukrainian troops there. So it looks as if the Battle of Pokrovsk is going to end, and that the end there is going to be grisly, with the Ukrainian troops inside Pokrovsk facing death or capture. The fall of Pokrovsk has long been seen as a decisive moment in the war, but it's beginning to look as if it's going to be only part of an even bigger picture, which is of a Russian advance northward, essentially to encircle the Ukrainians in Konstantinovka and ultimately Slavyansk and Kramatorsk as well, to create an enormous cauldron and to trap the Ukrainians in Donbass, the remaining Ukrainian defenders in Donbass, and to bring the great battle of Donbass finally to an end. I remember way back in 2022 when the war began, there were lots of speculations and debates and in fact claims, some of which I remember repeating at the time, about the Russian army working towards achieving a major encirclement of the Ukrainian troops in Donbass. That was in February, March 2022. Well, that didn't happen then, but perhaps it's going to happen now. This, it seems to me, is the reality of the war. A Russian army able to push forward almost at will. A Ukrainian army running out of men, unable to hold positions, even key positions, unable to establish coherent defense lines. A Ukrainian army perhaps facing collapse, or at least at risk of collapse, and perhaps at even greater risk of eventual encirclement of a summer offensive that the Russians are conducting which is beginning to give the impression that it's going to produce decisive results. Well, this is the reality on the battlefield, and I have to say it's making all the diplomatic activity, except perhaps Donald Trump's attempt to try to set up some kind of meeting with Putin in Alaska, is making all of the other diplomatic activity, the various statements and comments coming from Zelensky, the various statements and comments coming from all the various European leaders, it's making all of this look incredibly surreal to me. You would have thought that Zelensky, Merz, Starmer, Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, and Mark Rutte would be panicking about the situation on the Ukrainian battlefronts. I mean, that, it seems to me, is a legitimate reason to panic if you're in the West at this time. But they're not panicking about that at all. At least that's not my impression. They're panicking about something entirely different. The fact that Donald Trump is going to meet Vladimir Putin in Alaska. They've no reason to believe that this meeting is going to actually change anything in the overall diplomatic, geopolitical position. As we will see shortly, Donald Trump has actually denied that this meeting is going to achieve any such outcome. Yet, the mere fact that this meeting is taking place, that the leaders of America and Russia are actually going to be meeting face to face in Alaska, is a cause for alarm and despondency and all of that. Whilst the actual possible collapse of the Ukrainian army in Donbass and its eventual encirclement there is not something that even seems to register on their antennas. I have to say, I find this so strange, so mystifying, that it frankly leaves me speechless. Now, Donald Trump yesterday made a number of very interesting comments. First of all, he said that there's not going to be any deal between him and Putin in Alaska. That's not what the purpose of the meeting is. The purpose of the meeting is for Trump to get a sense of what Putin is about, to feel out Putin, in other words, to get a general feeling of where the Russians are going and what they're doing, and then maybe to take the matter further to try to find some way to end the war. That's what Trump said. He was absolutely explicit about this. So there is not going to be a deal in Alaska. All the talk about ceasefires, withdrawals from territory, the Ukrainians being asked to withdraw from Donetsk and all of that, that's for the moment possible topics for discussion, but there's not going to be an agreement of that kind between Trump and Putin in Alaska at this time. Now, those of you who follow these programs regularly, those of you who follow us on the Duran, Alex, Christopher and me, and who listen to what Alex says, well, you would find this completely unsurprising, because of course the gap between the Russians and the Ukrainians is enormous. There is no consensus so far about anything, to say it simply. Trump, who does, I suspect, have some idea that things on the Ukrainian battlefronts are taking a disastrous turn, who has been informed by Hegseth, the US defense secretary, about the critical situation in US inventories, and who has probably been informed by Scott Bessent about the disastrous effect of plunging into an economic war with China. By the way, on that front, Trump has just announced another 90-day extension of the tariff pause with China. It doesn't seem as if he's in any rush to impose the 100 or 500% tariffs on China that Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing sanctions would require him to do, and which he appeared to be threatening, well, was it just 5 weeks ago, just to say? Anyway, he doesn't seem to be in any rush to do any of all that. He's probably starting to get news about the effect of Chinese restrictions on the exports of rare earths, not just to the US military economy, which I suspect is now under significant stress, but US domestic industry. So, as I say, he doesn't seem to be rushing towards an economic war with China on Ukraine's behalf. This despite, by the way, the fact that Zelensky is still demanding this. Zelensky, bizarrely, telephoned Prime Minister Modi of India and pleaded with him yesterday to stop buying Russian oil. I mean, it does show, again, an extraordinary lack of reality on Zelensky's part, that something which Modi and India have refused to do when asked to stop doing it by the President of the United States, backed by threats of sanctions and tariffs, Zelensky appears to believe that he can persuade the Indians to stop doing, even though, of course, he's not able to threaten India with sanctions or tariffs at all. But anyway, I mean, maybe it's a waste of time wondering what exactly it is that Zelensky believes he can do or believes he can persuade people to do or not to do. My understanding is that Modi heard Zelensky out politely, but made it absolutely clear that India is not going to change its position in any way, and certainly not because Zelensky has phoned him. Anyway, to repeat again, Trump knows that the sanctions threat has not succeeded, that far from fragmenting, BRICS is uniting and consolidating. He knows about the critical state of US military inventories because Pete Hegseth and Elbridge Colby and others are telling him about it. And he probably has some idea of the critical situation of the Ukrainian army in Donbass. But the Europeans seem oblivious about this. I've been reading the British and European media, the German media, and apart from Julian Röpke at Bild-Zeitung, this all seems to be completely passing them by. They don't seem to realise the gravity of the situation around Pokrovsk, what is taking place there. They probably have little understanding of what's happening in Lyman. They no doubt are unaware of what Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, wrote about the reduction of the Ukrainian army, the way the Ukrainian army is now down to just 300,000 men on the battlefronts. I've actually heard it's less than that, more closer to 250,000. And that in terms of infantry fighting on the battlefronts, at times it is as few as 30,000 across this enormous, enormous conflict line. Anyway, I get the sense that the Europeans have no understanding or awareness of any of this at all. And, well, despite the fact, as I said, that Trump is meeting with Putin, trying to work out maybe whether there's some kind of way forward with Putin to end the war in a way that will at least save America's face and preserve something of its geopolitical position and maybe limit by agreement Russia's westward advances. Well, the Europeans are working overtime to wreck all of that and to make sure that the summit fails. So yesterday, reports appeared in parts of the British media that Zelensky has agreed reluctantly to allow the Russians to control whatever territory they currently occupy. And there's been a big article in the Daily Telegraph. It was the headline article of the Daily Telegraph for several hours. It's still the headline article in the Daily Telegraph as I make this video, saying that this is an exclusive information that they've obtained and a massive concession on Zelensky's part. It is nothing of the sort. It is nothing of the sort at all. Zelensky, the Ukrainians, in effect, conceded that the Russians would be able to hold on to their territory, the territory they currently occupy. Back in March, when Ukraine very reluctantly, after having US intelligence assistance and US weapons supplies cut off, agreed to a ceasefire. So it's absurd to say that this is something new on Zelensky's part. He's simply agreeing all over again to what he has already agreed to. In fact, he's not just agreed to it. He has now, over the last few weeks and months, as the situation on the battle lines has turned against him, what he reluctantly agreed to in March, a ceasefire with the Russians in control of the territory they occupy, he is now demanding, he has now actually taken to demanding, he is insisting that there must be an unconditional ceasefire, which would, of course, by definition, leave the Russians in control of the territory that they occupy. Of course, Trump is apparently floating ideas about land swaps going forward. And I should say at once that it, in my opinion now, it's becoming increasingly clear that this is an American idea, not a Russian one. I suspect that it was the Americans who floated to Putin over the course of Putin's meeting with Witkoff, the idea that the Russians agreed to a ceasefire in return for a Ukrainian pullout from Donetsk and Luhansk regions, freezing the conflict in Zaporozhye and Kherson on the existing front line. And I suspect that it is the Americans who have been floating also the idea that there should be land swaps, that the Ukrainians should cede control of further territory in Zaporozhye and Kherson to the Russians in return for the Russians handing over territory in Sumy and Kharkov and Dnipropetrovsk region. As I said, these all look to me increasingly like American ideas, ideas that the Russians are prepared to discuss. But to be clear again, they haven't agreed to them. And Donald Trump has just told us that there's not going to be a deal coming out of this meeting with Putin. He wants to discuss these ideas that he and Witkoff and perhaps Vance and others are coming up with. He wants to discuss these with Putin when he meets him in Alaska to see whether possibly, maybe, Putin is open to these ideas so that they can be taken up with Zelensky and so that Zelensky can be asked to agree to them. Well, as I said, so far, nothing of that has been agreed, but Zelensky is already rejecting it. He's refusing land swaps. He's refusing to withdraw from Donetsk. The only thing that he's conceding is what he has already conceded, which is that the Russians can control, can remain in control of the territory that they have now. He conceded that in March. It is manipulation, misrepresentation to claim that this is a new concession that he has made now. And, well, Trump, for his part, is showing signs of annoyance with Zelensky. He is clearly irritated that Zelensky, he said that he is irritated with Zelensky. He said this yesterday when Zelensky said that he cannot agree to land swaps because the Ukrainian constitution prohibits him from agreeing to land swaps. Trump, from what I can see, has the same cynical view of Zelensky's adherence to the Ukrainian constitution that Vladimir Putin has, and which, by the way, I do. It has always seemed to me that Zelensky discovers the Ukrainian constitution when it suits him and forgets it when it suits him too. It exists for Zelensky as something that he can hide behind, not something that he has any real deep belief in. Consider, for example, his own law, his own decree, which prohibited Ukraine from direct negotiations with Russia. He passed it in September, October 2022. He said that by Ukrainian law, no Ukrainian officials can meet and negotiate with the Russians. He's never cancelled that decree. It is still there in existence. But of course, Zelensky has ignored it. He sent 3 times negotiating teams to meet with the Russians in Istanbul. The Russians and the Ukrainians have come to agreements on humanitarian issues, about exchanging prisoners, about the Russians returning to Ukraine dead bodies of Ukrainian soldiers. They've exchanged memoranda about how the conflict might end. They are obviously negotiating with each other in purported violation of Zelensky's September-October 2022 decree. And, of course, Zelensky, who used to talk a lot about this decree, no longer does so. He has, as I said, consistently refused to rescind it. It's still there. But he pays no attention to it. So why assume that the Ukrainian constitution is going to bother him in the same way? Well, some will say it is the fundamental law of Ukraine. But then the fundamental law of Ukraine didn't stop President Yanukovych's overthrow in 2014, which on its face clearly violates the terms of Ukraine's constitution. And of course, the Ukrainian constitution has been amended to remove Ukraine's commitments to neutrality and to substitute for that a commitment for Ukraine eventually to join NATO. And as I said, I think that Trump, as well as Putin, see this document, this constitution, as an infinitely fungible document. And I believe that they believe that Zelensky sees it in the same way. Anyway, Trump clearly wasn't impressed. And though he spoke with unusual restraint about Zelensky when he talked about him yesterday, he made it very clear that he's not impressed by Zelensky's continued denials that he can countenance land swaps because this supposedly violates the terms of Ukraine's constitution. Anyway, there it is. The Europeans, the Ukrainians, continue to reject all substantive concessions. They continue to make the same demands for an unconditional ceasefire, for security guarantees to be provided to Ukraine. I discussed that all at length yesterday, and how that looks to me like a trap to involve the United States in the war. They continue to insist on all of that. They continue to be appalled, shocked by the fact that Donald Trump is meeting Vladimir Putin in Alaska, and the ongoing collapse of the Ukrainian army around Pokrovsk and the imminent fall of Pokrovsk doesn't seem to register with them at all. And of course, now we have the Chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, and he's called an emergency summit of European leaders together. And this is apparently going to be, I think, mostly a virtual summit, though perhaps some of the leaders will turn up and there'll be an in-person meeting as well. It's going to take place tomorrow. And there's been, again, a major effort to get Donald Trump himself to join the call. And it looks as if Donald Trump is indeed going to join the call. And the European leadership, the EU, has now published a joint statement. Every European country, including, by the way, Slovakia, signed up to it. Hungary refused to do so. And it's exactly the same as what one might expect. There can be no agreements without Ukraine, no questions of land swaps without Ukraine. There must be respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and all of that. It's all there in that EU statement. Again, I'm not going to pass it. There's no point in doing so. It remains as detached from reality as always. But as I said, an emergency meeting has been called. And the emergency, as I said, is not the crisis of the Ukrainian army, but the fact that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are going to meet in Alaska and exchange ideas with each other, even if they've already said, at least the Americans have already said, that they're not going to agree anything with each other. Again, I find this completely extraordinary. It's surreal. Doesn't, for me, capture the sheer absurdity of it. Anyway, Merz, it turns out, his great plan is to try to get Trump to move forward with the sanctions and the tariffs that Trump very unwisely promised or threatened the Russians with. And not just the Russians, but the Indians and the Chinese and all of the others with just a few weeks ago. And there's been a follow up. There's been there's a major concerted campaign across Europe now to get Trump to move forward with these sanctions and tariffs, to impose these sanctions and tariffs on Russia before the meeting between Trump and Putin on Friday. There's a long article, an editorial, no less, about this, all in the Financial Times, which, of course, predictably repeats this same demand. It insists that, there must be this decision, that this sanctions decision must be put in place. And the title of the editorial is How Trump Can Win in Alaska. Being tough with Putin is the only way for the US president to secure an end to the Ukraine war. And again, we have the claim, extraordinary claim, that the message Trump's Western counterparts should be impressing on the US leader is that a bad deal could be ruinous for Ukraine, for European and US security, and for Trump's legacy. We're told that the US president has already handed the Kremlin a gift by inviting Putin to Alaska rather than a third country, an indictee of the International Criminal Court, who should be a pariah for the unprovoked invasion of his neighbour, is being welcomed onto US soil. There are so many comments there that one can challenge in that one sentence, but I'm not going to waste time with it. There is symbolism, too, in the fact that Alaska was Russian territory before being sold to the United States in a real estate deal. There are still ways Trump could avoid a deeper disaster in Alaska. The guiding principle is that he should not discuss with Putin any matters of Ukrainian sovereignty or territorial integrity without involving President Zelensky. Above all, he must avoid any formal recognition of Russian occupation of Ukrainian land. Kiev's non-US allies have been rattled by Trump's hints that there would be some swapping of territories. And then we are told that Trump could still deliver a win by securing an unconditional ceasefire that freezes the conflict. Putin may have little incentive to compromise, but then we're told that the conflict is slowly draining Russia's economic lifeblood. As I've said, where is the evidence of this? And exacting a vast human toll that even this Kremlin may struggle to sustain indefinitely. Trump should revert in Alaska to his brief get tough approach and tell Putin that unless he suspends hostilities, the United States will further squeeze Russia's economy and oil exports and with its European allies pour arms into Ukraine. In other words, do more of the same. Do more of what has been attempted, not just since February 2022, when the original bone-crushing sanctions, the sanctions that Joe Biden and the Europeans imposed on Russia, the sanctions that were supposed to crater the Russian economy, halve its GDP, cause the Russian economy, as the French finance minister at the time said, to collapse. When those sanctions were imposed, the earlier sanctions that were imposed by Barack Obama and Angela Merkel in June 2014, the sectoral sanctions that were imposed then, the ones that Angela Merkel was briefed by German intelligence would lead to demands from the Russian oligarchs that unless Putin capitulated and withdrew completely from Ukraine, he would be at risk within 6 months of overthrow. those policies, those same policies that the West has followed, give Ukraine unlimited quantities of weapons, even weapons which no longer exist, give Ukraine endless amounts of money, even at the time of a worsening budgetary crisis across the West. Continue to do all of that, sanctions, arms deliveries, further infusions of money to Ukraine, and that somehow, if you hang on tough, that's going to work, even if it has consistently failed to work at any point up to now. And yes, Russia's inflation rate did get high. It did touch 10% briefly this year, though it's now falling fast. The Russian economy did flirt with recession in June and July, at least a contraction in June and July. But by the way, and for the record, and it's a point I want to repeat, I have made many, many times, I think that economic policymakers should never fear recessions, that a recession is a normal and sometimes necessary part of an economic cycle, that one of the major reasons why the West is in the crisis that it is in today, with uncontrolled budgets, with uncontrolled spending, is precisely because the West has repeatedly tried to abolish the normal economic cycle by treating recession as something that ought to be avoided at all costs by trying to insist that GDP growth be persisted in continuously. So if Russia did experience a brief contraction in June and July, which it might have done, well, that's not a disaster. That's a necessary thing if it brings inflation down, as the central bank intended, and as is now happening. People consistently get this wrong. Economies contract and they expand. Prices go up and they sometimes go down. This is part of the normal pulse of economic and commercial life. It absolutely does not mean that the lifeblood is being drained of Russia's economy, as the Financial Times is claiming absurdly. For the record, latest data shows that real wages continued to grow in Russia throughout this year. In other words, living standards have continued to rise since the recent cuts by the central bank in the interest rates. Lending in Russia has resumed. There is some evidence, as I discussed in my previous program, that the economy is now experiencing some kind of a rebound. It's likely in the last quarter of this year that for statistical reasons, Russia will show zero growth as compared with the surging growth in the last quarter of last year. But as I said, that's purely a statistical point. The economy has steadied and it looks like it's positioned for further growth next year again. The budget deficit is under control. The government's debt levels overall are falling. Output remains strong. There is no evidence that any of the things that the Financial Times is demanding, more weapons for Ukraine, more sanctions on Russia, are going to succeed. In fact, as I've discussed many times, it's not Russia's economic lifeblood that is draining away. It is Europe's. And if you live in Europe, if you travel around Europe, you see the evidence of that all around. The Financial Times is claiming, on the basis of threadbare evidence today, that there's been an increase in factory space, and it assumes that that means that there's going to be an increase in military production. This is entirely based on satellite photos of certain factories. To say that the evidence for this is threadbare is generous. It's not threadbare, it's non-existent. Anyway, put all that aside. The Financial Times, the leaders of Europe, they are persuaded that the crisis they are facing is that Trump and Putin are going to meet. They are oblivious to what is actually going on the Ukraine, on the Ukrainian front lines. They've called together an emergency meeting, which is going to be chaired by Merz, and they are going to demand from Donald Trump more of the same that has failed since February 2022, the same that has failed, in fact, since June 2014, when the West first began to impose sanctions on Russia and first began to send weapons to Ukraine. More of the same. What has ended up making Russia stronger and has led to the consolidation of the BRICS, and what has ended up making the United States and the collective West weaker as well. I cannot begin to say how incomprehensible this whole strategy is to me. Putting aside the cynicism and the objective cruelty of it, continuing a war that is being lost, continuing an economic war that is creating massive economic pressures and which is strengthening the other side, refusing to recognize the battlefield realities and demanding concessions of the Russians, which, when they're already winning. But that is what they're going to insist on. At the same time, they have also insisted, or are continuing to insist, that the Ukrainians be consulted, but they appear finally to have recognised, and Trump made it very clear in his comments yesterday, that Vladimir Zelensky is not going to be present in Alaska. All of those attempts by various American officials to try to get Vladimir Zelensky to Alaska, backed obviously by all of those European leaders as well, that has apparently failed. It looks as if Donald Trump understands that Zelensky's presence in Alaska would be merely disruptive, that there is no value at all in having him there, that in fact, if he is there, it will only cause further trouble and further problems. And for that reason, the Americans apparently have finally and conclusively decided that Zelensky has to be kept away. Now, you can be very critical of Donald Trump, and I have been many times, and others have been much more critical about him than me. And much of this criticism is completely justified, I should say, in my opinion. But on the decision he has just made to meet with Vladimir Putin in Alaska, I think that he is right. The military situation is in crisis. The sanctions tariff bluff has been called. The American military inventories are critically low. The Russians are about to break through in Donbass. Even the Ukrainians, even people like Yulian Rybka, are admitting as much. If Ukraine is going to be saved, then inevitably, unavoidably, that means that there have to be major concessions made to the Russians to save Ukraine. The alternative is to allow the war to continue, with the real possibility that Ukraine could in that case be entirely destroyed. There's been an article, rather I shouldn't say an article, a brief letter about this in the Irish Times by the historian Jeff Roberts, who I should say I count as a personal friend. So forgive me if I quote it, but it exactly expresses what I think is the reality in this situation, and which sets out in very measured and polite language, perhaps more polite than I am capable of now, what the true situation is. And this is what Jeff Roberts has said. Sir, this is to the Irish Times, the editor at the Irish Times. As your editorial on the forthcoming Putin summit in Alaska quite rightly states, the prize this week for Vladimir Putin would be a deal with Donald Trump that Ukraine cannot accept, with the US then walking away and washing its hands of the conflict. In that scenario, because that's what the Irish Times is saying, that there will be a deal done, or at least there will be ideas about land swaps, the Ukrainians would reject it, the Europeans would reject it, Trump would say, enough's enough, I'm walking away. In that scenario, Putin would be free to grab as much Ukrainian land as he wants, to continue to destroy Ukraine's infrastructure, and to inflict such a defeat on Ukraine that enables him to dictate peace terms and, quite possibly, imperil Ukraine's existence as an independent state. To thwart Putin, if that's your intention, if that's what you want to do, President Zelensky should heed the wishes of the great majority of Ukrainians. And there's been a Gallup poll now which shows that Ukrainians now overwhelmingly want peace, even if that means difficult compromises. The great majority of Ukrainians who now want to end the war with Russia, even if it means harsh compromises. Zelensky should engage constructively with whatever deal Trump manages to extract from Putin. Zelensky's European allies should support Trump's initiative by seeking their own summit with Putin. Surely the time has come to silence the guns through the pursuit of diplomacy and for EU members to curtail arms supplies to Kiev and instead pour resources into Ukraine's post-war reconstruction. The alternative to a diplomatic end to the war is, I fear, Ukraine's complete destruction as a sovereign state. Benjamin Franklin's aphorism that there never was a good war or a bad peace has never been more apposite. Yours, etc., Jeffrey Roberts. Well, isn't that right? If you really care for Ukraine, if you want to preserve Ukraine, and Ukraine's position has never been at greater risk than now, you don't undermine Trump. You don't try and bully him into tariffs and sanctions, which he's already looked at and which he now realizes would be a massive mistake, one which would create a massive crisis for the United States. You don't go on pumping Ukraine with weapons, or more to be more precise, making promises to Ukraine of pumping it with weapons, which you don't actually have and can never deliver. You seek some kind of diplomatic process with the Russians that might, just might, persuade the Russians to stop. I'm not sure that the Russians are in any mood to stop. I am not sure why they would want to stop at this time. Probably, and this is a point that many people who follow these programs are making, there is no sense for the Russians to stop. Vladimir Putin, by the way, is a most unusual political leader in one important respect. When it comes to the Minsk Agreement, which of course he mostly negotiated back in 2015 with Angela Merkel. Well, most political leaders who negotiated a deal like that, a deal which the Ukrainians went back on with the assistance of the Western powers, a deal which resulted in the Ukrainians buying themselves time and which put them in a better position to renew the war or to face the Russians when the war was renewed in 2022. Another leader, most Western leaders in that situation, would say, well, Minsk wasn't a mistake. Minsk actually turned out better for us because we were able to take steps to sort out the economy. We gained more from Minsk, the Minsk Agreement, than we lost. It wasn't the mistake that some people are saying it was. That's what any Western leader would say. That's not what Vladimir Putin ever says. Vladimir Putin says, quite straightforwardly, Minsk was a mistake. Angela Merkel, the Ukrainians and the West tricked me. That's a very unusual thing for a leader to say. But that's what Vladimir Putin says. That is almost certainly what he believes. So given that he believes that the West tricked him, at Minsk in 2015, why would he trust them now? He said that he doesn't trust them now. So given that he doesn't trust the West now, why would he agree to anything, let alone a Minsk 3? Why would he trust the Americans, the Europeans, or the Ukrainians with any kind of deal? Why would he seek a deal? Well, actually, there are reasons. I've discussed them many times. People like Eve Smith and Aurelien have discussed them also. Putin himself has talked about them, that ultimately a deal might be better for Russia if it creates even a temporary stabilization of Russia's western borders, allowing Russia to develop economically in future without having to worry all the time about a potential attack from the West. That's what Putin has said. That's his rationalization, his explanation of why he's interested in talks. But I wouldn't take this for granted if I was a Westerner. I wouldn't take it for granted that when Trump meets Putin in Alaska, Putin is actually interested in any kind of negotiation of the kind that perhaps Trump wants at all. There are many, many people in Russia, who do not want a negotiation, who would rather that the war continued, who would rather see Ukraine completely destroyed. Putin, for all his intense cynicism of the West, still thinks that there might be some benefit for Russia in coming to some kind of agreement with the United States and the West in order to stabilize the situation in Europe. But as I said, I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't count on the Russians continuing to stick by that position for much longer if there is a Ukrainian collapse in Donbass, if the Ukrainian army there is defeated and destroyed, if the Russians do reach the Dnieper, if Ukraine's ability to keep resisting has indeed gone. At that point, the arguments in Moscow to go on advancing all the way to Ukraine's western border might become overwhelming. And even Putin, who has shown a willingness, in spite of everything, to preserve some degree of dialogue with the United States and the West, might conclude that the moment for that has gone. Well, anyway, I've set it out. I've said it many times. I don't know what exactly it is that these leaders of the West think that they're doing, at least when I say the West, the leaders of Europe think they're doing. Probably, ultimately, they still tell themselves that America remains so powerful that if it uses its power, it can somehow still prevail. All of these European leaders, after all, have lived all of their lives, as by the way, I have done, in a world where the United States unequivocally was the most powerful and the richest country in the world, the country that emerged out of the Cold War as the hyperpower. Probably they still can't fathom the idea that that moment has passed, even as all of the evidence builds up around them. Probably they still imagine that it's somehow an absence of will rather than a limit of power that prevents America from triumphing over Putin and over Russia in the way that they believe. If I'm right about that, then all I can say is that the people of Ukraine and the people of Europe are going to pay a very, very high price indeed for the illusions of their leaders. And, well, that's perhaps the best that can be said. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. We will see how the events around Pokrovsk play out. I have to say that it's increasingly looking to me as if this, rather than the meeting between Trump and Putin on Friday, this military development around Pokrovsk is the really important big news of the week. Not that the meeting between Putin and Trump is unimportant, but of course, if there is a breakdown in Ukrainian defences between now and Friday, which by the way there might be, then of course the meeting between Putin and Trump in Alaska will take place in its shadow. That's me for today. There'll be more from me tomorrow. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. That's me for today. More from me soon.